We're working now. Yep. Awesome. Oh, that's a bit sad, isn't it? Stay there. That's great. Thanks, Callum. Just a few reflections this morning on this story and putting it into the context of this bigger picture that we've been entering into over these last weeks, the whole idea of the end of us and them, and this way that in Luke's gospel particularly, there's a sense in which all of these people who were considered to be on the outside, Jesus sees as being on the inside. In fact, any idea even of there being insiders and outsiders is completely disrupted and turned on its heads. And this is a story which does a similar thing to us. And unfortunately for us, the story is mostly been known in the world of evangelical churches, at least, as the story of the prodigal son. That's the title that we're familiar with when we think of the story. And that's unfortunate, because what it does is it highlights just one character in what is a complex story, which has multiple messages, has some layered messages in it. And so what I wanted to do this morning is just retell the story in a slightly different way, using a little bit of imagination, and see if we can get into the heads and hearts of some of those characters. So it's important in coming to the story to realize the setting in Luke's gospel, apart from this big theme of the end of them and us that runs through the whole story. In this particular scene, before Jesus tells these three stories, including the one about a father and two sons, let's just call it that for now, he's being criticized by the religious leaders of the day. They are present, and as the rabble, as they consider them, are gathering around to listen to Jesus, the Pharisees and teachers of the law are whispering amongst themselves and saying, this man welcomes sinners and eats with them. So they're highly critical of the company he's keeping. He's hanging out with the riffraff. And so Jesus tells these series of stories. And included among them is the story of a father and two sons. And if we just kind of think about this for a moment, these as two brothers who grow up together on a farm. And they have some good times together, but they also compete and squabble and argue and fight, just like siblings do. And let's just humor me for a moment. We'll give them a couple of names today because they're good Hebrew-sounding names, Quentin and Seamus. That should work, shouldn't it? We'll just kind of shift the paradigm a little bit here. But Quentin's the older brother and Seamus is the younger brother. And Seamus watches his older brother working hard on the farm. It's kind of like Quentin carries the responsibilities of older son firmly on his shoulders. And Seamus is kind of the rabble-rouser in the family, often getting into arguments with the parents and getting into trouble. And Quentin watches his brother working on the farm. He watches him doing what he thinks his father wants. And he sees that Quentin's staying in the father's good books, or he thinks he's staying in the father's good books, whereas he's kind of drifting out of them. And he kind of comes to the conclusion, I can never be like my older brother. I can never perform the way he does. No matter how hard I try, I just can't quite make the grade. And so in his heart, he's becoming more distant from his father, more distant from his brother. And he kind of comes to the conclusion that he might as well leave home. That there's no place in his father's heart for him. There's no place in his brother's heart for him. He might as well leave. But he doesn't have any means to look after himself. So he hatches a plan. He goes to his father and he says, Dad, can you give me my share of the estate? And this is effectively Seamus saying to Dad, I'd prefer you dead, Dad, because you don't usually divvy up your will, your estate, before death. That's a post-death event. And Seamus is coming to Dad and saying, hey, Dad, could you divide up the estate now? Sell my share and give me the coin, give me the money, and then I can do what I want with it. And in this story that Jesus tells, as these others who are critics of his are listening in, they are shocked by the fact that as Jesus tells the story here, Dad says to Seamus, I'll do it. And he sells up that third of the estate and cashes it up and gives the money to his young son. So how is Quentin feeling about this? He's not feeling good. This precious estate, this farm, this economic unit, which he has rights to two-thirds of in accord with the custom of the day, has now been divvied up, and its capacity for production and so on is under threat. So he's not feeling happy about this. Seamus ups and leaves the place. He's not feeling the love at home. He can't really see into his father's heart. He's reared in a particular way, but he can certainly read his brother's heart, and all the vibes that he's getting from Big Bro is, you know, you're trash. You get out of here. You're just an annoyance. And now that you've done this, there's real enmity between the two of them. And he can feel that vibe, so he disappears. In the story, we need to understand that this is like a dagger in the heart of the father, this request. That this is a sense that his younger son is wanting him effectively dead. Doesn't want the relationship, just wants the stuff. Doesn't want to be connected, just wants the coinage. And he knows he can't force his love on his son, so that's why he lets him go. It's worth noting how Jesus tells the story from this point. He says that not long after that, the younger son, Quentin, packs up all he has, and which isn't very much, but he's got the coin in hand, and he heads off for a far country. He wants to get as far away as he can. And there he wastes his money on wild living. He spends everything he has, and when the whole country hits a famine, so he doesn't have what he needs, he has to go to work for somebody in the lowest kind of job that a young Jewish man could conceive of, working in a piggery, looking after animals that were deemed unclean. It says that he got so hungry he wanted to fill his stomach with the food the pigs were eating. I had some friends of ours who had a big piggery out the back of Belfast, and I can tell you, watching those pigs get fed and smelling what was being fed to them, was stomach churning. And so in this story, there's kind of this picture, this sickening picture of how low he has sunk, having been able to spend everything that he did have, but now finishing up in this place. Not a flash one for a kid brought up on kosher food. And meanwhile, of course, Quentin's back on the farm. He's working away diligently, serving his father, doing what he thinks will keep his father happy. But after all these years, he's still carrying the simmering pool of anger and resentment towards the younger brother who had been the one who had made that decision which led to the farm being, the third of that farm being sold. So he's still carrying that resentment. And he's kind of sitting there waiting for the day when his dad dies so he can hear it, that two-thirds, and do what he wants with it. In the story, we find that we've got a few pictures somewhere, actually. If you just want to flick forward, you'll find some that are pertinent to the scene, if you could, Luke. Yeah, just keep going. Yep, just hold it there. Yeah. So here's the scene when he's sitting in this place of having come to the end of, the money has dried up. And he realizes that this place that he's in is not the place he wants to be. The plans that he had haven't led to that wonderful life that he was looking for. And he begins to think to himself, how many of my dad's servants have more than enough food? And here I am dying of hunger. I'm going to get up and I'm going to go back and I'll say to Dad, let me just be a hired servant. And I've sinned against you, I've sinned against heaven, but let me just be a hired servant. You see, this hollowness in his stomach is accompanied by a hollowness in his heart. He's not only a down and out outwardly, but he's down and out inwardly. And he's thinking, if I'm going to get back into a place where at least I've got food in my stomach, if I offer to just be a servant for my father, then at least I'll have that substance. So, curious. He can't see any relationship beyond that of being a hired servant in the house. He can't see a relationship of sonship being possible, of being a member of that family in that kind of a way. But he gets up and he goes back. The scripture says he dreams of this. And his homecoming is something which is totally off the charts in terms of expectation. His father, as Jesus tells the story, had been looking for him. And it says, while he was still a long way off, he saw him. There's this kind of sense where the father has been waiting and longing for the return of the son who has left, in spite of what he did, in spite of the shame that he bore. And it says that he ran to him, threw his arms around him and kissed him. And those of you who have heard this story so many times know that, you know, the Eastern father didn't gather up his garments and run down the road. That was a very undignified thing to do. It wasn't the cultural response. He would wait for the son to come and maybe give him an embrace and a kiss on the cheek. But to run down the road with tears in his eyes and compassion in his heart and embrace his son was something totally off the charts in terms of expectation. And Quentin begins his explanation, you know, Dad, I've sinned against heaven, I've sinned against you, I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. And his father interrupts him. Whoa, whoa. You know, let's bring the best robe. Let's put a ring on your finger. Let's put sandals on your feet. Let's clean you up. Let's kill the best cattle beast that we have. Invite the neighbors in the village and have a party because you've been lost and now you've found. You were dead. I thought you were dead. Now you're alive. And there's this enormous sense of celebration in God's heart about this return, in the father's heart in the story, rather, as the story is told. Let's get this other sheet here. In thinking about this kind of return, can see why the story of this younger son has so captivated the imagination of people in churches for so long. But the story is really only moving to the place, as Jesus tells it, where the real message is going to come home to his intended listeners, who are the people who have been criticizing him. No doubt there are others sitting in that circle who are those who would consider themselves to be like that son who had wandered. You feel alienated from any sense of community with brothers and sisters who seem so to have their spiritual act together, so to speak, to have their religious ducks in a row, to have their moral code well identified and well kept. And these are people sitting in the midst who feel like they don't sit in that circle at all. They sit completely outside of it. But there are these ones who think that they are the insiders. And Jesus is wanting to bring his message home to them. As Jesus tells the story, he says, Quentin, the older brother's out in the field. And when he comes near the house, he hears the music and dancing. And he calls one of the servants. He won't even go and talk to his father to find out. This anger that has been sitting in his heart for so long, for all these years gathering. And he asks the servant what's going on. And I'm interested in the language that is used in the parable. Your brother has come home, the servant says. Your father has killed the fattest calf. He has done this because your brother is back safe and sound. It's the language of relationship This is your brother. This is your brother. He's come home. And Quentin, of course, is furious. He is incensed. This ratbag brother of his, Seamus, this little piece of donkey poo, as it were. I can think of all the names maybe that were running around inside his head. Has come back. He broke all the rules. He ruined the estate. He disrespected and shamed the family. And now Dad's killed the best cattle beast and he's put on this party for him and invited the town. So he stands outside. He doesn't want to come inside. And there's a sense where this, in the telling of the story, you can feel the resentment of the older brother. So the father goes out and it says he begs him, he pleads with him to come in and not to stand out. But he answers his father and here's the resentment coming to the surface finally. All these years, I've worked like a slave for you. Notice the language, like a slave. No sense of relationship there, no fondness, no affection, no understanding of his father's heart. It's all boiled down now to this long road of obedience, this dutiful conformity to what he thinks his father wants. He says, I've always obeyed your orders. See, he only sees the relationship as defined by orders. My father orders me to do things. I do them. That's the nature of the relationship. You never even gave me a young goat so that I could celebrate with my friends. I wonder if kind of he grew up with a sense of love is scarce in this home, and if I'm going to earn it, if I'm going to get it, I must earn it. It's very easy to grow up in a family, isn't it, and think there's not enough love to go around. You've got to do something to warrant the love that comes from your guardian or your caregiver or your parent. It can feel like there's a competition going on in the home for the love that maybe is scarce. Certainly seems there's a bit of that scarcity mentality here for this older brother. And then he says, the son of yours wasted your money with some prostitutes. There's nothing in the story that suggests, again, that's actually how he spent his money, possibly did. But is he just kind of amping the story up? The blacker I make the other, the whiter my grey becomes. He's oblivious to the fact that his is in that zone. But, you know, if I can just paint the story of what's happened with my younger brother with some more vivid colours, it kind of might make me look a little better, because maybe subconsciously he's aware that this is what has been lurking in his heart. And then the father speaks to him and he says, my son, he affirms the relationship. My son, you are always with me and everything I have is yours. And that's true, because what's left of that estate has actually been handed over in terms of the way the story works. Everything I have is yours, but we had to celebrate and be glad. This brother of yours was dead, now he's alive. He's lost, now he's found. Step back into the circle, Quentin, because it's big enough to contain you and your brother, whatever you think of him. It's big enough to dissolve that toxic mix of resentment and anger that you carry within your own heart and replace it with something different. Because Quentin, as I've said, doesn't understand his father's heart. He thinks he's stingy and unfair. He's stupid and unreasonable. He thinks he should be rewarded for his hard work and obedience, and his brother should be punished for his indulgence and his wastefulness. And he's saying, if my father won't punish my brother, I will. I want no relationship with that son of his. I'll shut him out, and I'll also shut my father out. It's gone deep, hasn't it? It's gone real deep, but the story leaves us on this note with this riddle, this challenge. Because whether it's in a church or a whānau or our own families, when we come estranged from one another with very real and sometimes imaginary offences, to find our way back into the circle of love together can be hugely challenging. And this story says there can be an end to them and us when the grace of God in Christ, reflected in the face of this Father, finds its way into our own hearts and lives. It leaves us with the question this morning, or I'd like to, who in our families are we shutting out? Who have been pushed off into the margins? Who have we judged as not being acceptable when Jesus is saying, they're in my circle, include them in yours? I'm going to hand back to Cullen, and then we'll get some chance to have a bit of an engagement with this further.